I'm Tegan Klein, the co-founder of Edge & Node, working on The Graph. Today we have Sam Williams, the co-founder and CEO of Arweave. Arweave enables you to store data, applications, and documents forever, from war articles to NFTs. We dive into the profound use cases on Arweave, what Sam says to those that say Arweave might be too expensive to store certain files, how Arweave is used to store NFTs so that they can live forever, and how you can actually earn money with Arweave. Let's dive in. So Sam, I would love to begin with your story. How did you first get started in crypto and why?
So I first heard about Bitcoin back in, I think it was approximately 2010 or 2011, when the tokens were worth about 3 cents. And a friend of mine told me about this magic internet money. And I thought that was vaguely interesting. But you know, it was just magic internet money. It's like, that's curious, but not, let's say, serious. And then it wasn't until, I guess, 2 years later, I started mining Bitcoin with a friend of mine from university in the in the university computers after dark in the computer science lab, just for fun, to kind of play with it and see what sort of hash rate we could get. And I think that was when the first major wave of innovation was starting to happen, also around consensus mechanisms in blockchains. There was this altcoin sub-forum on Bitcoin Talk, where all of this stuff was happening, and people were just starting to experiment with, well, does it always have to be proof of work in the traditional sense of SHA-256? And of course, the first one of those was Litecoin, used script, if I remember correctly, the hashing algorithm, as an alternate. And it was just play at that time. There was no real rhyme or reason to it. But it was interesting. People were starting to explore the idea of incentivizing behavior through these decentralized networks. And so then I took some of my, I think, $15 that I'd mined worth of Bitcoin and put it into the Ethereum ICO, because I saw someone on Hacker News post it, and I was like, wow, the world computer, as they advertised themselves at the time, that sounds like a pretty cool thing. And I thought I would just buy, and naively, I thought that would be like AWS credits or equivalent, and $15 wouldn't go very far. But it turns out, like, you know, those were 70 cent ETH at that time. So I held on to these for a while. And then I noticed Storge, which was, I guess, the second or third project to do an ICO. And that was very interesting because they were using the same idea of blockchains, but now, and you know, incentivizing behavior without an intermediary. They were using that to approach a sort of fundamental computer science challenge, which is data storage. How do we store data? And doing it, yeah, trustlessly, I thought was very, very cool as an idea. Unfortunately, Storage didn't really go very far, but and they never picked up my tokens. but it was an interesting enough idea. And then I guess I dropped out of the loop for a while. Or I remember at one point I was like, oh, okay, cool. This Ethereum thing has actually launched now. That must have been like 2015, 2016. I was like, okay, cool. How do I host my website on it? And that was a mistake. I had not, like, cottoned on to the global world computer, as it was advertised, one would assume could serve websites. But what we actually got was something that was cool, but completely, completely different. Just like smart contracts, which is the basis, really, of a trustless system of finance. At least at this point, that's the core use case. Very interesting idea, totally different than storing and hosting websites. so I learned I couldn't do the thing I wanted to do with it, like, almost instantly. And then I dropped it again. And then it wasn't until 2017, I guess, early 2017, Donald Trump had just been elected. And I was starting to think about, I was very worried about the state of censorship on the internet at this point. Like, you could see the walls were closing in a little bit on the internet that I had known when I was young. And I thought that was a terrible shame. And I thought, and I still think, that free speech on the internet is a fundamental part of modern democracy. We're not going to be able to keep democracy if we don't allow people to debate ideas and disagree, hopefully respectfully, but at least just disagree. And then they come to consensus when they go to the ballot box. It's the loop. It is the cycle. And if you get in the way and you start twisting the process of debate, more or less all is lost. And while we have free speech rights in the physical space, I was looking at the world and seeing, well, because the way the protocols are set up on the internet, you don't have free speech rights of any real sort, because the protocols enforce that you speak to a server that is in a location and someone owns that location and there's no getting around it. Like, that is the way that the system works, and you just can't build a system that properly guarantees rights. And so, you know, Trump had just been elected. The world was, I would say, destabilizing one way or another. And I thought that, well, there's sort of combined problems here, which is like memory of the past, as George Orwell put it. The person that controls the present controls the past. The person that controls the past controls the future, right? If you can change the way people think about the past, you can change the way they act. It was a pretty fundamental thing. And at the same time, I read The Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, which is a description of the Soviet concentration camp system, as well as A Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, which is a description of the concentration camp system in Germany, and then also Aquariums of Pyongyang, which same thing, but unfortunately in a more modern day in North Korea. And this gave me a real sense of, would you say, the seriousness of how bad the world can get if we let it. Like, this kind of chaos and nightmare is not actually all that far below the surface. And so you could say that our civic responsibility to make sure that we maintain democracy and freedom is very, very serious and is pressing. And so I saw the world slipping in that direction in the West in a way that hadn't happened before in my lifetime. I had all of these ideas swirling around my head. And then I was thinking back to, and at the time I was doing a PhD in distributed operating system design. And I was getting towards the end of it, and I was starting to think, well, what's the appropriate thing to do next? And my PhD had all been about basically like integrity of compute. How can you build an operating system that when run on a computer and the computer undergoes physical harm, the operating system continues computing stuff? That was the core principle of it. And I thought, well, it's hard to describe the single reason. There was no single reason. It was a whole bunch of reasons. And that led me to this epiphany that was like, wait, why don't we use these blockchain systems that are essentially ledgers of information, and that information can really be whatever you want it to be, to make a redundant, highly reliable system of speech storage, frankly. And the first thing that came to mind was, can we store newspaper articles in this thing so that you can basically replicate the newspaper articles in so many places around the world that it's really impossible to edit records of the past? And then that quickly expanded from, well, newspaper articles are good, but what about the speech of, you know, everyday common people? Like, why don't we give this ability to everyone? And that was what started the Arweave project. It was early 2017.
Amazing. There's so much I want to dig into there. I think that the topic of free speech is very much a topic of today. I think we live in this time of cancel culture where if you're offended by something, you just want to completely erase that person that offended you from, you know, your view and your world. And I think that can be really dangerous when, you know, you need to debate people. I grew up in a small town in Ohio where people had crazy views of the world. And if I was the one kind of there contesting that. And I think that doesn't really exist today. And we need to kind of bring that back. And even with the Balenciaga ad, which I was completely outraged very publicly about, I was like, maybe these people should be investigated. But then I'm like, actually, no, they shouldn't, because it's free speech. And, you know, they haven't broken the law. And so, yeah, I guess what's your opinion on that, just given all of the recent events of today and kind of canceling of Kanye West for the things that he said and things like that?
Yeah, well, funnily, yeah, this is very topical or timely. Last night, I watched this video of Tim Pool. Tim Pool had Kanye West and a bunch of other, let's say, pretty extreme right-wing people on his show. And you know, there was a big drama. Should you even give a platform to such people? And the interview lasted 20 minutes, in which basically the interviewer asked some very basic questions, just extremely simple questions. And the extreme ideology showed itself to be baseless and ridiculous instantly, and made the people espousing that ideology, you know, didn't make them look good at all. I don't think anyone would come away from watching that and think, wow, such great ideas. Sunlight really is the best disinfectant. And in a democratic system, we have essentially all made the bargain that we're going to have to be exposed to ideas that we don't like, but we do so such that we can correct those wrong ideas. And then we can come to better consensus as a group. And realistically, the group is also going to get it wrong a lot of the time, but it's better than dictatorship, which is the only real alternative, or technocratic dictatorship, you could say, which is seemingly alarmingly the suggestion by a significant part of the public at this point.
Yeah, sunlight is the biggest disinfectant. I love that. And I think the thing is, when you do cancel people, it allows their views to become a lot larger, because others with those similar views then pile on. And so I agree that, you know, we need to debate and discuss it openly. The other piece I wanted to dig into was just around incentives. I think incentives and coordination are the two things that we can use to make the world a better place, you know. And so I would love to understand, like, for magic internet money, was it the fact that we could use this technology to change incentives that really made you start to mine and kind of dig in?
I think that in the case of Bitcoin, it was less about the incentives and more about the fact that you could have simply a trustless mint. Like, what if you put the monetary system outside the control of any individual or group? That's really an astonishing thing that's never been done before. It's really quite profound. It was the way I thought about it and still do. It's less about incentives in that early stage, but you saw as things progressed to, say, Ethereum, and then with Storj, that was actually the first time where people were really like starting to oscillate around this idea of protocol-based mechanism design. And they were very naive experiments in some sense. And arguably, you know, there were incentives in all the peer-to-peer protocols before that. Like BitTorrent was, I think, really the first one that tried to be explicit about these incentives. Brian Cohen wrote this paper called Incentives Build Resilience in the BitTorrent Protocol, or something like that, where he was basically arguing that because they have this optimistic tit-for-tat mechanism of trading data, which basically says, well, I'm going to trade data with people that trade data with me, and occasionally I'm going to randomly trade data with people. And it turns out that the net effect of that mechanism is a Nash equilibrium where everyone is trading data with everyone else all the time. So these protocols that can, would you say, engineer incentives or incentive aware are very exciting. And then, you know, really it was about 2016, 2017, people started experimenting with that in earnest. And I think Arweave is now a pretty big experiment in this area that says, okay, well, let's build a technical mechanism for proving that you are storing a piece of data. That's a fundamental part of it. And then on top of that, a mechanism design, which rewards people over time for storing data. So in Arweave's case, we are really interested in permanent data storage. Once you put a piece of data into Arweave, it is neutrally stored permanently. Like, you don't have control over it after you put the data on the network. It's held in sort of common good, if you will. It's for all people to access. And you also don't need to pay for it again. Well, how can you achieve that, right? The way that we approach this problem is we say, okay, so you pay for 200 years worth of data storage at the present price. And then as the cost of storage declines, that 200 years expands out. And as it happens, the cost of storage declines at a relatively high rate, typically. And we require just a very low rate, which is 0.5% storage cost decline per year. And then if you maintain that principle, you'd say, then you end up at the end of any given year with more storage purchasing power than you had at the start, which is very strange to get your head around, but it's true. You can look at the math and you can work it out for yourself. So with this system, we see, okay, now you can properly make sure that for at least the lifetime of the protocol, if not far longer, there is good incentive for people to store the data, or money around to give to people to store the data. Yeah, so we were thinking about it from a sort of economic engineering perspective, and then there's this technical perspective. And you add it together and you get a global, permanent, neutral ledger of speech, basically. And a big part of this is also that anyone has the ability to add data to this network. There are archives, sure, and some of these archives have even been functioning for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Like, that's pretty good going. But to add your data to that archive required the archivist to care about your data, which is a huge power game, right? Like, you know, it costs hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars to set these things up. And then your likelihood of success is actually relatively low for storing data, you know, into the 100+ year mark. Well, we try to build an archive that is credibly neutral and democratically accessible. Really, anyone has the right to put information that they care enough to pay for into the network.
So here's a big question. What's the most important thing about crypto? It's not transactions per second. It's not convenience, and it's not even smart contracts. It's decentralization to achieve censorship resistance so we can all be free. Minima is a new layer one blockchain designed to run in full on a smartphone. Join hundreds of thousands of node runners on Minima's incentive program today to start earning Minima every day until mainnet launch. Get started at minima.global.
The last thing I want to double click into is just that initial spark of excitement around website hosting with Ethereum. I know when I teach a lot of people about this industry, that's one of the things that they're actually really excited about initially. So what do you think that that Web3 stack will look like to be able to host a website in Web3?
Yeah, it's a ledger of speech, but what can that speech be? Well, it can be anything, it turns out, including websites. And then you can point your web browser to an Arweave gateway stroke a transaction ID, or even using this thing called Arweave name service, just a name, like, you know, sam.arweave.dev is an example, which is my personal website, and it will be served back from the network for you. So Arweave does that sort of base data storage layer. And then on top of that, we get things like the graph, for example, which very helpfully indexes all the data inside Arweave. So you can add tags to your data. So while, you know, some pieces of data are the full, you know, web application itself, other things are, for example, my tweets, right? So there's this thing called Public Square, which is a data protocol on Arweave. And it's basically just a way of saying, okay, I upload a piece of data, I tag it in the right way, and now it shows up as social media posts in all of these different user interfaces. And so what practically happens there is that an indexing service like the graph has to come along and pick up those pieces of data from Arweave, and then you can query those servers, and those are, you know, decentralized networks. You can query them and say, hey, please give me all of the posts from Sam between this date and that date. And then you can do that in a fully decentralized way and then render proper decentralized web applications to the end user. And it's one of those funny things where when it works properly, you don't even realize it's happening, which is, I think you and I probably share some thoughts and concerns about, well, how do we surface to people how decentralized their web applications truly are? And I think that's probably going to be a big point of contention for the next cycle. Like, I think one of the things we relearned the hard way, unfortunately, in 2020 to 2022, summer 2022, the end of that cycle, was like, centralization slips in all over the place because it is easy, and it is profoundly negative for the, it ruins the promise of these services. And so, yeah, I think there's really interesting questions to be asked about, well, how do we surface to the end user, hey, this part of the application you're using is decentralized, but this part isn't. You know, I think, Tegan, you and I have had this conversation before about, back in, say, 2018, 2019, all these things that were calling themselves decentralized were actually just, sure, the smart contract, which is a small part of the engine of the application, is properly decentralized. It's on Ethereum or, you know, some other chain. But the UI and the data storage and the indexing and the databases, all of that's totally centralized. And so the end user might think that they're using something decentralized, but the developer disappears or what have you, and boom, the whole thing breaks. It's like, well, if it breaks when the dev disappears, then it wasn't decentralized because it was centralized on the developer.
Totally. Yeah. And I believe in permanent applications, right? And that's kind of what we're striving for within this industry. And you can't have a permanent application if there are these central points of failure. And we've seen a lot of people kind of take shortcuts and centralize part of their applications, partially because things aren't ready, but also partially because they want to go to market and it's easier, it's faster. And I think, you know, you and I have been thinking about decentralization and kind of shouting it from the rooftops for a long time. And what I can tell you is that so many reporters, so many people didn't care, right? And some people even went as so far as to say, you know, it doesn't matter, the end user doesn't care. And for me, like, the end user shouldn't have to care, right? We should care so that the end user doesn't have to care. And we just need to make decentralization better, faster, cheaper, more robust. And I think that that's actually happening. And, you know, one of the silver linings with FTX is that people are starting to care about decentralization. It's changing, it's shifting. So any comments that you would add there?
I mean, I think it is shifting. I think you're totally right about the, you could say, the incentives for developers, particularly when you're in this sort of hype part of the market cycle. Yeah, it's very difficult to get people to really care about this stuff that is slower. Generally, it's harder to build something decentralized than centralized, or at least it was. And I think you're also correct that, well, the tooling is starting to get to the point where it's as easy, say, to store a piece of data on Arweave as it is on S3 at this point. And that we've reached that level. But, you know, there's a bunch of other parts of the stack that have to come into place. And it has to be packaged in the right way as well. Like, there has to be, I don't think that we should have an AWS. That's not a good idea, because of course that will itself be a centralized thing, which will become a crux. But some sort of tooling, like developer-side tooling that starts stitching together all of these applications, that would be great. And I think it is on the horizon, if not coming pretty rapidly. So there is good news, but I'm curious, what are your thoughts on the OFAC sanctioned blocks in Ethereum? Like, what's the,
there was a great talk during DevCon with the Flashbots team about it. It seems as though that they are trying to address it, but yeah, for any listeners out there that haven't seen that talk, I highly recommend it, but it's scary. What are your thoughts?
I remember the ethos of Ethereum in the beginning, and I must say that nowadays I am less excited about what that might become. I don't think it's the only thing out there that I'm playing in this area, so it's okay. But it was very easy for the, let's say, cypherpunk roots of this whole industry to get lost in the wash of capital, basically, that came its way over the last decade. I hope that Ethereum still finds a solution to this problem. I think that Vitalik posted some interesting ideas about how we can start to do that. So they seem to still care, at least, let's say, in the leaders in that ecosystem. But I think, practically speaking, a lot of the uses of Ethereum, at least so far, have been in a sort of, let's say, more in the realm of digital casino than a system that's fundamentally built to improve the rights of users of the internet and maybe the financial system. But that's a little bit pessimistic. I am hopeful that they will get things back on track. And we see this every single time there's a crypto boom and bust cycle, right? Like, there's, you know, there's a sort of core of people that are quite committed to the key ideals. And then the excitement grows and a lot of people come in that are not so, let's say, versed in the principles of the thing, or so excited even about the principles of the thing. And that grows to you know, the point where we have, like, Mark Zuckerberg's sister making that amazing We're All Gonna Make It song. I think that's, like, the good top call for the market. You know, you get that kind of craziness, and then it all disappears. But some of the people that come in during those waves, they actually do hook onto the principles. And as the market recedes and there's a sort of period of rebuilding, then there are more people that are committed to those ideals at the end of that process than there were at the beginning. And that has happened like 3 or 4 times in the last decade. So yeah, I'm hopeful that we will get there, but I do find it concerning, I guess. And I worry about the idea of eternal September. Okay, so back in the early days of the internet, I think it was basically what used to happen was every year the freshmen at college would get introduced to the internet, and they would come along to all the mailing lists. And this is like, you know, late 80s, early 90s. They would come along to the mailing lists and they had no etiquette. They would just spam everything. Like, they did everything wrong for a few months around September time. And then they would become sort of indoctrinated in the culture of the thing, and they would understand the rules of the game. And so you got this increasing size of a core community that still had the same ideals. But I think it was either the September of 1990 and 1991 or 92, But one of those, there was what they called the Eternal September. There was just such a wash of new users that they actually destroyed the culture and it never rebuilt. Like there was just such a concentration of new people relative to old people. The old people tried to educate them about, you know, why are we here? What, you know, how do we operate in this space? And it didn't get picked up, unfortunately. So I'm hopeful that we don't have one of those, but it is a serious threat we should think through.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there always is this learning curve. And I think Bitcoin really does kind of hold down the fort when it comes to a lot of the core principles. And I think Ethereum is kind of catching up. I think the Ethereum community was a bit, naive, maybe optimistic that the government would kind of do the right thing. And now we're seeing that maybe the government's a little bit threatened and not necessarily doing the right thing, potentially. I view the core values of and principles of this space as being, you know, decentralization, open source, trustless tech that's permissionless, but also censorship resistant. And I think censorship resistance is the one that's kind of being relearned right now. Would you agree with those principles? Is there anything else that you would add? And maybe if you want to share a little bit on why you think that they're important for everyone to learn.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think I would totally agree with that. I would only say that to me, decentralization is not an end, it's a means. Like, why do we need decentralization? Well, because we need censorship resistance, more or less. And that leads me to one of my biggest concerns about Ethereum, which is, well, if they've given up censorship resistance, someone at some point is going to be like, wait, why does this thing even need to be decentralized? And unfortunately, that person is going to be right. And then they're going to build this is the dark vision of the future, I worry, is around the corner. They're going to build basically smart contract environments running in something essentially like AWS, and it's going to be faster, cheaper, and also private easily without having to use ZK proofs, right? You can just permission who has access to the protocol, and then you can do, let's say, programmatic finance, not decentralized finance. On such a system, it would be fast, easy, and I think people would like it, unfortunately, and that scares me because it is washes away the core principles of why we're here. And so why should we care about that? Well, I would say that technology that is trustless and permissionless gives us the ability to make systems in society that are fundamentally more open and kind of like an extension of the principles of democracy itself. Openness, transparency, and it's almost like fairness under the law, like equality under the law, except equality under the protocols. So Arweave doesn't care who you are. You're allowed to speak. And I, as the person that founded the thing in the first place, cannot change that. I have no preferential say. And so while companies can give you a sort of promise of how they're going to act in the future, protocols can give you guarantees and rights as a user, which is something you just can't get unless you have these properties that we're striving for. And I think that's just such an exciting future. It's probably one of the only areas of technology where there's really a very obvious, exciting future ahead. That is pro-social, obviously pro-social. I mean, in the AI space, it's fascinating what's happening, but wow, you can see how all that stuff could. Well, it's just not clear which way that coin lands, you know, whether it's a good or a bad thing, or most likely somewhere in between. But with this technology, look, if you agree with the principles of democracy and freedom and equality under the law, then once you grok the meme, which is, hey, these are protocols which preserve your rights and have a fair game that is set out from the beginning and can't change that game. If you can grok that meme, then I think that you start to realize how exciting this idea of Web3 can be. Like, what if we can apply that to web services? And then now you don't have to trust people's promises. You can trust the code. You can trust the math instead. And math tends to be, let's say, more immutable than people.
Very well said. I think Web3 at its core is really just about empowering individuals, and all of these tech pieces are coming together to do that and enable that.
Web3 is weighed down by fragmented experiences becoming more of an obstacle for users rather than a warm invitation. Core seeks to erase these points of friction. Built by the team behind Avalanche, Core is an all-in-one command center for Web3, supporting Avalanche, Ethereum, and Bitcoin, a rich ecosystem of dApps, Bitcoin and Ethereum bridges, NFTs, subnets, and more. Download the Core browser extension to get started and connect to the Core web to unlock additional features at core.app.
I know we could talk about this for forever, but I would love to dig into Arweave. And you touched a little bit on that founding story, but I would love to hear a little bit more. When did all of this happen, and how did it happen?
Yeah, well, so I had that original idea for, hey, what if we just make a globally replicated, basically blockchain-based database of newspaper articles. I had that idea, it was early 2017. And then I was actually walking on a mountain with my father, and there's this funny photo he's got of me standing there in the rain on my phone trying to jot down all these ideas, and he's really annoyed that I'm like not walking up this hill. But that ended up probably being worth the 5 minutes of writing. But by the time I came off the mountain, I was like, okay, I see a plan here. I see a way that we can do this. At the time, the technology was pretty primitive. It's like, okay, let's take Bitcoin. Let's, you know, at that point, it was pretty obvious that 1 megabyte blocks every 10 minutes were not all that we could put in throughput on this thing and still maintain decentralization. So you could very clearly just increase block size, or really it's consensus megabytes per minute. And I figured, okay, well, let's strip out all of the excess data from these newspaper articles online. So let's just make it so that we're just storing the text. That's good enough. Like it's basic, but it will work. So I got down the mountain, called a bunch of my friends who were, you know, doing PhDs or let's say were in tangential areas that I kind of saw a vision for, hey, who's going to be needed to put together this team and do this. And you know, a few days later we had a team, had an idea. Then we were starting to prepare like the basic version or the marketing materials actually started with, right? You have to tell people about this idea. And then one night, you know, I was up late. I couldn't sleep, which I'm a night owl, so not uncommon. And I got this idea, wait, you know, instead of just talking about this thing, can we just build it? Like, how hard is it to build a blockchain, right? I don't know. So I get to my computer, and then like by 3 a.m. I have something vaguely resembling a blockchain. And then, you know, 2 weeks later I had what was essentially the prototype for Arweave, which was great. And so we wrote a paper about it. We had this prototype, started to build a community, raised a small amount of money. At the time it felt like a big amount of money, but I guess relatively speaking, it was about $400K dollars. And yeah, and then we started to build things out. And at that time, this was the 2017 market cycle. So we saw that, you know, the price of Bitcoin was rocketing from like basically 3K to, I think in October that year, it hit 10K, and then, or someone actually said, yeah, it's probably end of November it hit 10K, and then, but the end of December it hit 20K. And we're like, wow, something is, you know, I'm excited about the future of a central bankless global currency. Wouldn't that be great? But guys, it's not worth six times as much now as it was at the beginning of the year. That's just, you know, faulty market behavior. And so we got very concerned at that point. And sure enough, things started to crash. And then at that point, we were going to a startup accelerator in Berlin. And we headed out there and we met a bunch of people. That was a kind of transformative, you know, experience, because before that we'd just all been in academia. We had no idea how the business world worked at all. And we knew nobody. And I mean like precisely zero people. Everyone in the really early Arweave community that we met were just from Bitcoin Talk. Had this big thread where you'd answer all the questions. And that was just the way we did business. It was kind of natural to us. But this, you know, opened us up to the world of, let's say, like in-person business and that kind of thing. So we were building out the network. We were sprinting to get this thing done. By June 8th, 2018, which is the 69th anniversary of the publishing of 1984. And the nice thing about using an anniversary like that as a launch date is you can't move it. And so really like kept us in line for shipping on time. We managed to raise sort of a larger round at that point. And then came the winter, which was pretty dark. And the early days of Arweave, you know, it was very, very quiet. Like we were fixing up the system, there are lots of bugs and stuff. I mean, nothing, say, critical, fortunately, but like just, hey, the network needs to function properly, and building blockchains, it turns out, is relatively difficult. So there were months and months of going through that process. And then it was around December 2018 where there was this this thing called the Kerch Strait incident, which basically, to summarize, a complex geopolitical event, a bunch of Ukrainian sailors were taken captive by the Russian Navy in the Kerch Strait, which is actually just where that bridge that recently got blown up is located. It was basically under that bridge, if I remember correctly. And at that point, someone from our community archived a newspaper article, or newspaper, a website article from Sputnik, which was Russian propaganda. It's like Russian state media, but English-speaking. The first Russian state media English-speaking article about this event, of which, of course, Russia was one of the two parties. And very strangely, this article was written in a super pro-Ukrainian way. Not what you'd expect. And then it was gone 14 minutes later. But, of course, we'd embedded this record of history inside this blockchain that had distributed it all over the world. And now we have a provable timestamp that says, no, this came from this location and it hadn't changed. Like you can go back to this article now, 5 years later. It's pristine, byte for byte, bit for bit, the same. And we can prove that cryptographically. And that was when people, and you know, that was for me a moment where it was like, you know, we've ever so slightly started to fulfill the mission, at least. Like it was like, was 0 to 1 moment. And then from there, it's just been scaling. So after that, there was an archive of about 600 to 800,000, let's say, data points from the Hong Kong protests, really the whole arc of the Hong Kong protests all the way through to the instigation of the national security law. All of that is stored inside Arwi, from a massive historical record of it, stored in hundreds, if not thousands, of places around the world at this point, impossible to alter by any party. And then, you know, after the national security law came along, people started archiving the pro-democracy newspapers, which were getting shut down, onto the network. And sure enough, those records are, of course, spread all across the world as well, in a way they just can't be changed. Same with coronavirus censorship back in 2020. And then, you know, really it's just been snowballing ever since then until it reached, say, February this year, or it's actually late January, we started archiving the community about 70 to 80 million pieces of data from the or social media signals, most of it, not exclusively, but a lot of it, out of Russia and Ukraine at that time, about the start of the war. And so ever since then, we've just been building this enormous archive of historical records and disputing it all over the world so that no one can change it. And it's now like 450 million pieces of data. And in the meantime, the crypto industry discovered that, oh, wait, if you're going to sell a piece of data in some form, like if you're going to, one way or another, commercialize or monetize a piece of data, we sure as hell need to, like an NFT, you sure as hell need to make sure that that data doesn't disappear. Because if it does, then your users have basically bought nothing, right? And so when the NFT boom happened, people realized, oh, Arweave is the perfect place to store this because we can store data in a way where you pay once and you store it perpetually. It's distributed in such a fashion that anyone can access it. So it's public by default rather than some of the other networks which are private only. Which just makes it the perfect fit for NFTs. And so we saw a huge spike in usage last year as the NFT boom sort of took off. And now all of those projects are also using Arweave. So there's, I guess, this social side, why we're excited about Arweave, and then the crypto commercial side.
Yeah, yeah. If it's not stored on Arweave, it's not a non-fungible token, in my opinion.
Until now, crypto privacy has come at the expense of DeFi functionality. The brand new and high-tech Railway private wallet on web and mobile lets you enjoy the world of DeFi while staying completely private. Create an invisible wallet balance, sell and buy tokens privately and anonymously like a dark pool, and enjoy DeGen DeFi goodness without revealing sensitive information like your address, balances, or transaction history. Railway is available on Ethereum, BSC, and Polygon.
I would love to double click into, you know, this gets very political. And so how do you ensure that there's trust there from both sides or from all sides, and that Arweave isn't viewed as kind of being on one side or the other?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this as well, because I think Graph is in a similar position. But the way that I see this is, like protocol founders, it's really important to try and ensure the integrity, the neutral integrity of the protocol. So when things were archived out of Ukraine and Russia, we didn't express an opinion about that. It's just, well, our opinion is really one thing, which is that, or two things, I guess. It's important to keep a neutral ledger of the past. Let's just store the information about the past so that we can learn from it in the future. That is position number one. And position number two is that, in general, free speech is good. And those are our opinions. And the protocol is engineered to you say, pursue those goals. We have no other opinions. And we really try very, very hard to ensure that we maintain that neutrality as best as possible. Even when we have opinions about, we have lots of personal opinions one way or another about geopolitics and local politics all the time, but that's not the point. Really, like, we are building a coalition to push forward these two fundamental ideas and nothing more. And honestly, it's something that I see in the industry today is not well, let's say, respected. You know, I think Satoshi did this best. Satoshi did so much right. It's astonishing to believe that that was actually the first experiment in this space. It's really remarkable in many ways. But they said their piece. They said, guys, it would be good if we could build a system, an international form of money that no one has to trust any other party apart from math to make it coherent. That's the idea. That's the political speech, if you will. And then it ended. They just stopped speaking. And it worked still. I think my hunch is that Satoshi was still out there in the early Bitcoin community actively contributing, but under a different pseudonym. That was a fantastic idea, if that's indeed what they did. We made the... I wonder if it's a mistake. It's possibly a mistake. But the choice to use real names, be doxxed, as they say on crypto Twitter. When we started out, we can't undo that. So it is what it is. But I do try and personally keep my speech to really just those core ideas, and I'll keep everything else to myself.
Totally. Yeah, I have a lot of respect for that. There are days, though, that I wish that I had gone back and did it all anonymously, but, you know, you can undo it, like you said. Yeah, and for us, you know, there's a reason that the first core developer within the Graph ecosystem is now called EdgeNode, and, you know, the Graph is a decentralized protocol. It is neutral. However, like, I, as an individual, I'm not always neutral, and anyone that's had a private conversation with me knows that I have a lot of opinions. But yeah, I have a lot of respect for the way that you approach it. And it is a challenge.
Yeah, I think the people that know me also know I have opinions. I just try not to. It's a little bit of a funny thing, right? Because we made this network to try and further free speech. But the net effect on me personally was actually I lost my ability to speak freely about my thoughts in public. But it's an okay sacrifice. It's just kind of humorous in a way.
Totally. I think we need more of your opinions, though. And, you know, there are many profound use cases on our Reef. You touched on a few of those. I know a lot with the Ukrainian war have also been archived on our Reef. Can you talk a little bit about your favorite use cases over the years?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's this funny thing that happens occasionally where we wake up and something interesting has happened out of China. And it's always we wake up because we're always west of China. So it's always happening in our nighttime. We wake up and it's like, oh, there's a Reuters article about how people have been archiving, for example, Apple Daily, which was a pro-democracy newspaper in Hong Kong, onto the network. And that happened completely without our knowledge. We just woke up and it was there one day. So that's pretty amazing. It's those use cases. And then another one, earlier this year, there was a video put together called Songs of April, if I remember correctly. Which collected audio recordings of calls with the emergency services in Shanghai during the lockdown there. And I guess this must have leaked, this collection, or, you know, a set of these things. They stitched it together into a video, which was shared very, very widely on the ground in Shanghai. And then, of course, it got censored on social media. And so someone uploaded it to R Drive. And boom, you had a huge traffic spike, probably 40x the normal amount of traffic coming out of China to get hold of this file. And of course, it's stored there around the world as a perpetual record of history now. Those are some of the things you could say I find most meaningful about the work. Like, I feel like we're doing our job properly when those things happen. And the other side is I'd say early, but really exciting, which is we're building provably neutral web applications on top of the Arweave network, right? Because if you have a permanently stored user interface and you have permanently stored user data, both of which are out of the control of the people that upload them after they upload them, well, now you can build web applications that are, well, provably neutral, trustworthy. And that's just something that, well, that's my website hosting that I wanted to do on Ethereum, what, like 6-7 years ago, but couldn't. Well, now you can actually do it. And that's really starting to take shape. So you can go to something called Arweave gateway, but Arweave.dev, for example. Fax.arweave.dev will take you to, I think it is the first provably neutral newspaper in the world. It's pretty cool. So you can go there and you can write an article, basically, and people can come along and they can take part in what are, from mechanism design perspective, they're bonding curves, technically speaking. But really, it's just a way of buying into the idea that this thing is true or false. And if you think that it's undervalued on either one of those angles, then you can buy. And if other people buy in the future, the price goes up and you get this sort of curve of pricing. And it estimates the crowd's belief in the truthiness or non-truthiness of a statement. And this is really interesting because you can take this neutral data from the market and then you can basically rank order all of the new articles, say everything posted in the last 3 days, I think is how the algorithm works, onto the homepage in the order in which people believe they are true and relevant. And so, and you can pull this data back from any Arweave gateway. And even the person that uploaded the app in the first place has no privileged right to change how that system works. So now you can build for the first time, I think, a provably neutral newspaper. It's really quite, I think it's going to be amazing. So I'm very excited about that kind of thing.
Amazing. I love that. And I think that there's a good parallel of plugging that into Geo, the Web3 browser that's built on the graph. And I'll make that connection after this call. But I would love to, now that we've talked about some of the profound use cases, let's circle back to NFTs. I, for one, did not see the NFT boom coming, but it's really kind of remarkable to look back and see how, you know, mainstream NFTs really went. And so that's one of the main use cases, or a big use case of Arweave, is that immutability with NFT metadata. Can you talk a little bit about that? How does it work? Which NFTs are storing on Arweave today, and how much would it cost for someone to store their NFT on Arweave?
Yeah, so the interesting thing is, even though it's permanent storage and all, well, for a start, all permanent storage exists within a risk model. In our case, we're saying, okay, the cost of storing data should decline at a rate above 0.5%. Yeah, all permanent data storage can only exist within a risk model. Otherwise, it's magic beans. It doesn't exist. Well, yeah, you'd think that was expensive. 200 years sounds like a long time, right? Well, it turns out storage is actually very cheap. So for something like an NFT, we'd say like an image or that kind of thing, it's only really a few cents to store it. Typically, it's approximately half a cent to a cent per megabyte in general. So if you have an NFT image, it's, you know, normally 1 or 2 cents to upload it to the network permanently. And that's pretty cool because it's actually very cheap relative to just your normal smart contract interactions to generate the contract on, you know, Ethereum. It's like $30 to generate an NFT in the height of a boom last year. Even something like Solana, the Arweave storage fees are relatively small compared to the cost of smart contract interactions. So the price is pretty low, comparatively speaking, which is great. Yeah, and I think you mentioned, like, well, how does it work and how can you access it potentially? And the answer to that, it's pretty cool. You can use something called Bundler Network to upload data to Arweave, paying in tokens on other networks. There's about 11 of these. So really, like, all of the base networks that anyone's really using for smart contracts, as well as the L2s on Ethereum, they're essentially all covered. And you can pay in the native tokens on those systems to Bundler Network, who then use the Arweave token to store the data on the Arweave network. And that's a pretty neat system that makes it highly available to all people that want to store data.
That's great. And then, you know, some say that Arweave is quite expensive. And I know some people have given the use case of maybe wanting to store a movie on Arweave and not wanting to pay so much for that. What would you say to those people maybe that think the idea of storing, you know, permanently isn't the right idea here, and that maybe they just want to store it for a short period of time?
Well, it depends on what it is. Like, you shouldn't store short-term data on our Weave. It's not what it's built for. It's like saying, well, should you take a jet 10 miles down the road? Well, no, it's not what it's built for. But, you know, if you are, in the case of, for example, NFTs, or really any Web3 data that is financialized, well, you can't sell someone a product where the data is going to disappear. Like, that doesn't make any sense at all. And it's probably also not a commodity if you do that, because you're having to rely on the centralized management of others to continue paying for the upkeep of the data. So it's not suitable for all use cases. We actually even think that, you know, that there is a space in the world for impermanent data that's provably impermanent. You know, one of the things we spent a while thinking about along the way was, hey, if we wanted to make the anti-Arweave for things that you wanted to be ephemeral, is that possible to protocolize? It turns out I think that problem is harder than building permanent storage. So we're not like, we don't think that absolutely everything in the world should be stored permanently. I don't think that would be a good world at all. But in the case of, you know, records of history or things that you want to let's say, publish widely as possible, well, Arweave is an amazing distribution channel because it will make, A, your data be around for centuries to come so other people can access it and view it, and B, it'll make your data show up in many different applications because it's a sort of open permissionless data lake, so all of the data is shared between all the different apps. That's a great use case for the system. If you're going to financialize the data, you want to make sure that the data is going to be permanently publicly available. Otherwise, what are you actually selling? Like, you're just selling a contract that points to data that will eventually be lost. That's no good either. So yeah, it depends on your use case is the answer.
The product market fit seems to be the permanence.
Yes, absolutely. That is what the system is. And it's highly, highly specified and built for that use case. It can actually scale, particularly with bundling, something that the Bundler Network offers, arbitrarily large, in terms of the amount of data being uploaded in a single transaction and also the amount of transactions in general. Like, you can bundle all these transactions together into one base layer transaction and settle that in one go. And that can be essentially any size. This is only really possible because it's permanent data storage. So you don't have to remember the state of any set of bytes being different than any other set of bytes. Like, in a temporary data storage system, you have to say, okay, this set of bytes Tegan wants to store for 1 year, and she wants it to be stored on three different nodes, right? That's different than my data, which I want to store for 10 years on two nodes or six nodes or whatever. But that is very, very, very difficult to scale, if not impossible to scale in that way. You always end up making this sort of aggregation argument. Well, Arweave is built from the ground up to support that, so it just arbitrarily scales data storage. And yeah, and to be frank, as an early investor in storage, I don't know that that temporary decentralized data storage has product market fit. I've seen a bunch of different projects try this over time, and none of them have actually. Some of them have tried buying users, let's say. But they haven't ever reached, like, the users are grabbing it from them and they can't give it to the users fast enough type of level of product market fit. I think it's the sad truth, or I guess it comes back to this question of, is decentralization an end or a means? And in Arweave's case, it's a means. Like, we need decentralization in order to make sure that no one can edit the ledger of history, and to make sure it's properly resiliently stored in such a fashion that, you know, if there's disaster at any particular physical place, it's not going to affect the network. Also, to run the business model of the endowment. The endowment, you know, is built to run for hundreds, if not thousands of years. You can't trust a company to do that. They can make you promises, but they can't make you guarantees.
I just want to shift gears and talk a little bit about some of the controversial use cases on Arweave, and, you know, how do you deal with some of those issues, maybe of illicit content? What are some of the biggest problems you've encountered so far?
Well, very few actual problems. This was something we heard a lot about in the early days. What if people use it for this? What if people use it for that? My learning from the world is that, fortunately, there really aren't that many bad people, it seems. Like, people are generally better than people expect them to be. There really haven't been so many negative use cases of the network. But when there are, say, there are mechanisms built in for this. So Arweave will give you a guarantee of permanence if and only if you pay, you upload the data, and someone is willing to store it at every time step. So essentially how this works is that every miner, because all of the data is public, can decide what it is that they want to store. And there's no centralized consensus. You know, you don't need 51% of people to decide that it should be stored. So minority speech is still protected, political speech. But you are publicly liable for the data that you store. And you're given the tools to protect your node and say, okay, I don't want to store data that's illicit or that I find immoral. And the incentives against doing so are very highly stacked, you could say. Like, you're really incentivized not to do this by the world around you. When you have an Arweave node, you are publicly saying what it is that you're storing. And so what you essentially get is, well, data that is illegal essentially everywhere or seen as morally reprehensible everywhere then just isn't stored in the network. And so that's a fairly easy one. And then when it is, say, different people in different parts of the world have different views on it and sort of, we say, equivalent to the amount at which they have different views on it, then that might be stored in some places but not in other places. And so you get it's really based on the idea that each node operator should be responsible for what they do and can be held accountable. And then we get a decentralized system of content moderation that arises from that.
Right. It's on the nodes to ensure that they are upholding the laws and values in their region. And then can you talk a little bit about the usability of the Arweave token and how it's kind of used as an incentive in the protocol?
Yeah, so simply put, you use Arweave tokens to buy storage in the system. When you do so, we put about 84% of those tokens into the endowment and 16% goes to the miner who mines that transaction into a block, because you still need that incentive to include transactions in the first place. And then over time, those tokens are released from the endowment. And the interesting thing here, of course, is that means tokens pile up in the endowment. And when the cost of storage declines at a rate higher than 0.5%, which is essentially every year on record apart from 2 or 3, then you actually just bank more capital for the future, for rainy days, you could say, to pay for storage. And so it just gets like an increasing amount of the supply just gets parked in this network-controlled zone where, for rainy days in the future.
And if for those listening, maybe they want to start mining AR tokens, what would be involved in that?
Excitingly, with Arweave 2.6, which comes out, I think we're shooting for a hard fork in about mid-January, community ascent depending. That will enable you, hopefully, with just a hard drive, and I say hopefully because you never quite be sure what the miners will do. they're excessively inventive, which is fantastic in a way, as long as it's, channeled in the right direction. but 2.6 should incentivize miners to run on just normal hard drives, like spinning disk hard drives that you might have inside your laptop or your desktop. And that's really exciting because it means you can now compete with the other miners in the system without having an ASIC, without having GPUs, even just with the hardware that's on your normal device. So we're very excited about that. This really should open up the opportunity for typical people that aren't diehards doing this all day, every day to take part in the network and subsequently cause further decentralization of the data set.
Yeah, that's great. Further decentralization, absolutely. I think that's one thing Bitcoin really got right. It's like the ability to run it yourself at a low cost. So that's great that you're moving in that direction. And then the final question is just, how are you defiant? How do you define yourself as defiant?
I would never do so. I don't like to define myself as anything. I'll let other people do that.
I love that. Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Sam, for the time. I know we could have gone on for a lot longer, but maybe we'll have you back for a part 2 at some point.
Amazing. Thanks so much for the opportunity.